Welcome to episode 59. I'm going to be talking about a term that was actually coined by an editor of mine. The term is biographology. Where does this come from? As far as I know, it's not actually a term that's in use other than my use of it. Before I tell you exactly what I mean by this term, I want to back up a bit and tell you a story going back to the year 2003, when there was a new newspaper in New York called the New York Sun, which had a brief life, a very conservative newspaper. I don't think its circulation ever went above 100,000. Its politics were not my politics, but that didn't matter to me. There was an editor, Robert Messinger, who had several editing jobs, including editing the book pages of the Wall Street Journal. But before that, he was quite a young editor who was given charge of the arts and books page at the New York Sun. And he asked me to write a review of a book by Bernard Schweitzer. Actually, it was a book that Bernard had edited called Survivors in Mexico, which was a piecing together of a book that Rebecca West never finished about Mexico, which would have rivaled her masterpiece, Black Lamb and Gray Falcon, I believe, and I, in fact, called it in my biography of Rebecca West an unfinished masterpiece. And that's why Robert Messinger had called on me. By the way, this was rather unusual. I've done a lot of book reviews, almost always at my instigation, contacting some editor. I've very rarely been asked to actually write a review out of the blue, almost never. But Robert Messinger knew my work, knew my West biography, and he also had a keen interest in biography. At any rate, I wrote this review, which he was very pleased with. And because this was a new newspaper, I thought I might have an opportunity here. And so I pitched to him the idea of a book review column, and I outlined to him my profound disappointment in reviews of biography. And what I was complaining about then, I complain about to this very day. I said to him, when I read reviews of biography, it's like the reviewer doesn't know how to read biography, doesn't know what to look for, treats the biography as content, that is the story of somebody's life, which it is, but as if who put it together and how the biography was put together is apparently of no interest whatsoever. Very rarely do you get a review of a biography which really gets into its style, its structure, and most importantly for me, if it's a well-known figure or at least a figure about whom there's been two or more biographies, the reviewer rarely even mentions those other biographies, or if the reviewer does, it's just in passing. This partly has to do with just the exigencies of book reviewing. The fact that reviewers don't get paid a lot, they're not given a lot of time to review books, and they're often not qualified to review the books they're given. This is especially true in the New York Times Book Review, where the name of the reviewer, the reputation of the reviewer, is much more important than whether that reviewer actually knows anything about the biographical subject. And I was saying all this to Robert Messinger, and I said, I want to do a book review column which really deals with the provenance of biographies. Where do they come from? What are the biographer's sources? What other biographies have there been of the subject, if there have been other biographies? What does this look like compared to, if it's a literary biography in general? I had this whole range of issues, which another editor, the New York Sun, then used the term once in an email to me that I was a biographologist. I was writing biographology. And that's what I was attempting to do. The other thing I want to say, I should say that I wasn't a staff writer on the New York Sun, but every week I wrote this book review column starting in 2003 for the next about 3 years. And these reviews have been collected in, I've actually self-published these New York Sun reviews in several books, one of which I'll be reading from, Lives of the Novelists, but also in a book called American Biography, and in Reading Biography, these are separate titles, in my book Female Icons, and also Essays in Biography, all self-published, all, I should say, available as audiobooks as well as ebooks and paperback. At any rate, there was another reason for writing this column, which was I thought I might be done as a biographer. It had been exhausting, exhilarating, expensive to do biography. Most of my biographies up to that point were done by trade houses. I had done 7 biographies of Marilyn Monroe, Lillian Hellman, Martha Gellhorn, Norman Mailer, Rebecca West, with my wife Susan Sontag, and Joe Craigie. That biography, the Craigie biography, didn't appear until 2003, but it was done earlier, and it was just awaiting publication. At any rate, I thought, well, now I'm going to pontificate about biography, which is going to be a lot easier. I'm going to read biographies, and I'm going to draw on my own experience as a biographer. And I wasn't sure I would ever write another biography. We're talking about 2003, 2004, 2005. I wrote 2 books about the nature of biography, A Higher Form of Cannibalism, Adventures in the Art and Politics of Biography, and also Biography, A User's Guide. Both of these books are still in print, and both, again, are also audiobooks. I would especially recommend A Higher Form of Cannibalism, which I think is the one book of all my books that really gets at my sense of humor. And it's one of my shorter books, and it is a kind of tour, really, of the 19th and 20th centuries in terms of how biographies have gotten produced and the people who have tried to stop some of these biographies and so on. Well, biographology. I wrote a little note when I pitched the idea of biographology to Robert Messinger. I was describing my disappointment with book reviewers. In this, I'm reading from Lives of the Novelists about biographology. I'm expressing my disappointment in biographers. I've coined a term, a reading now from this book. There are 7 short chapters, sections of this idea on biographology and Lives of the Novelists. I have coined a term to articulate my dismay at biographers who ignore the work of their predecessors. Unlike novelists who create de novo, biographers work from sources that provide an incremental and cumulative view of their subjects. To ignore this biographical tradition is to diminish a sense of biography as a genre. Biographology is then akin to historiography, the history of history. Biographology is the biography of biography, or rather the biography of biographers, who can sometimes be remarkably ungenerous to their own kind. I think I got interested in this too, because as an undergraduate, I studied historiography, even though as an undergraduate, I took a graduate course in historiography as well, and was much influenced by writers like Wilhelm Dilthey and R.G. Collingwood and Herbert Butterfield, particularly his book George III and His Historians, which is remarkable in its understanding of how biography develops over periods of time and ages and why biographies change and so on. I'm going to read to you a little bit from a review of a biography of Kafka by Nicholas Murray. I'm not going to read you the whole review, but just the parts which particularly get at what I mean by biographology. I say in this review, biographies of major literary figures ought to be cumulative, what I just said about biographology, providing the reader with a sense of where in the historical process a particular biographer enters. Mr. Murray does make a vague effort to help us place his work, observing that in the years immediately following Kafka's death, he was reviewed as a quasi-religious writer, an allegorist of religious themes, a modern everyman. I'm quoting Murray. Absurdist and existentialists abstracted and absorbed Kafka as one of their own, coining the term Kafkaesque for the menacing and meaningless world they found in his writings. But the last half of the 20th century, Mr. Murray continues, has developed a more nuanced picture. By focusing on the writer's Prague background, his Jewishness, his intimate family and romantic relationships, so that he has emerged as a particular man in a particular place at a particular time. That's what biography is. As I say, this Kafka is one of Mr. Murray's, this is the Kafka that Mr. Murray's biography presents. Good enough. Except, what about all those other biographies of the last half century? Now, this is often true with biographers. I'm digressing here from my reading. That is, what the biographer wants to impress you with is the newness, of course, of his or her book, of their primary sources. And the idea of using secondary sources is almost, well, not a no-no. The biographer might sort of wave a hand at previous biographers, but unless they want to pick a big quarrel, and sometimes that happens, and that's can be fun too, and sometimes unfair, unless that biographer wants to pick a quarrel with other biographers, they almost act as if that those other biographies don't exist. And that's why I say, what about the late Frederick Carl's monumental Franz Kafka Representative Man, with its all-encompassing second subtitle, Prague, Germans, Jews, and the Crisis of Modernism. This was published in 1991. Or Ronald Heyman's thriftier Kafka, A Biography, that had been published in 1981. To mention just two of a half a dozen or so Kafka biographies that have appeared in English. Well, you can see the problem with being a biographologist. You have to know all this stuff. You have to read all these things. What book reviewer has time to do that? That's part of the problem. But a biographer, Nicholas Murray in this case, ought to have the time to do it. And he probably has read all these books, but he doesn't want to say anything about them, I guess, because they're the competition or because he thinks he's all, you know, better or more advanced or what? Well, that's it. We don't know. That's what I would like to know. I go on to quote a passage from Fred Carl's book, which I'm not going to read to you now, but I want to say what Carl says. He says, Carl writes what he calls, this is Frederick Carl, critical biography, by which he means a work that integrates the literary figure's writing into a portrait of the writer's many selves. Carl refers to Mr. Heyman's book as only biographical. But Mr. Heyman certainly focuses on Kafka's work. Indeed, he begins with a discussion of Kafka's story, The Judgment. A sentence of Mr. Heyman's biography. This is part of biographology. I'm reviewing Nicholas Murray, but I've got to review him in terms of what I know has already been done on Kafka. Biographies are books, and you've got to describe them as books. And so many reviews describe biographies as lives, which in a sense they are, of course. But if you just get a sort of a potted biography of the subject's life, you're miles away from what a biography actually is. A sentence of Mr. Heyman's, I believe, clarifies matters. I'm quoting now from Heyman. Kafka's whole life was a series of hesitations in the process of condemning himself and carrying out the execution. That is such a riveting sentence. Let me read it again. And before I do that, I'm going to just take a sip of tea here. Again, Ronald Heyman. Kafka's whole life was a series of hesitations in the process of condemning himself and carrying out the execution. I say, I cannot imagine Carl or Mr. Murray writing such a sentence. It compresses the different Kafkas into a single conceit, an organizing principle that allows the biographer to write deftly and elegantly, producing one of those 300-page biographies that the British in particular favor, but which are hailed by relieved viewers the world around. I once had a British agent who, when I start proposing a biography, the first words out of her mouth were, 90,000 words? Because 90,000 words would get you in under 300 pages. Anything else they considered a doorstop. Of course, long biographies do get written in English and by the English. Just ask Michael Holroyd. Nevertheless, when I did a second biography of Martha Gellhorn and pared it down to close to 90,000 words, boy, the publishers and my agent were just over the moon. They loved that. They thought that was great. I go on to say Mr. Heyman's approach is as good as far as it goes. It will not do to call him reductive when, in fact, that is what biography is, or one form of it anyway. There is nothing wrong, to my mind, with an exclusive biographical focus. My focus, by the way, in The Last Days of Sylvia Plath is primarily biographical. That is, I don't go into detail in her work, and this is often reviewers will often, when you're doing a literary figure, say, oh, this is terrible, Rollison or whoever it is, doesn't say much about the writer's work. The writer writes, yes, but the writer is a sensibility, is a temperament, and you can learn a lot about that temperament from reading W.A. Swanberg's Dreiser, for example, which is not a work of literary criticism at all. And yet you'll never read Dreiser the same way again once you read Swanberg. That's the point. Of course, there are other ways to write biography, as Mr. Carl demonstrates without denigrating his predecessors. But the Heyman approach allows the biographer to focus with great intensity on what he believes is the governing law of a life. Still seeking a sense of what might separate Mr. Murray from other biographers, I examine the way he treats Kafka's death wish that all his unfinished and unpublished work be burnt. Murray finds the writer's instruction to his friend and first biographer, Max Brod, exactingly comprehensive and utterly unambiguous. Kafka at this time wanted to perform a kind of self-cancellation. That's Murray. I like at this time, for one aspect of Mr.'s biography is that is skillfully pursued, whether or not it is new, is this sense of circumstances and of temporality. The self is shaped by contingency. I was amazed at first that Mr. Heyman makes no comment at all on Kafka's death wish. He just quotes it. But then why comment given the sentence of Mr. Heyman's, the one I quoted earlier about self-cancellation? In his view of Kafka's motivations, every creative act implicitly leads to destruction. Kafka possessed a guiding sensibility that events cannot alter. There's a nice tension between Murray's view and Heyman's view, which I think readers need to know about. Then there is Carl, who deals with Kafka's death wish a half a dozen times throughout the biography, implying that the writer's instructions to Brod were nothing but ambiguous, and purposely so. This biographer involves the terrible looming figure of the father, who never took the slightest interest in his son's writing, and who, in his son's words, becomes the very voice of defeatism. Kafka came to fear success, Carl suggests, invoking the judgment, Kafka's story, and this is why he told Brod to destroy everything. The more things I was successful in, the worse the final outcome would inevitably be. That's Kafka. Well, that's one way of writing what I call biographology. There's another way where one biographer is intensely conscious of another, in a way writes in such a way that you can't avoid dealing with more than one biography of the subject. In this case, Mark Twain. I reviewed Fred Kaplan's biography called The Singular Mark Twain. And I begin my review this way. Fred Kaplan understands that the answer to one biography is always another biography. His work turns Mr. Clemens and Mark Twain, Justin Kaplan's justly esteemed biography, on its head. Professing great respect for his predecessor's book, Fred Kaplan nonetheless insists on a different perspective, signaled in his title. Whereas Justin sees a rift between Sam, the Victorian moralist, and Mark, the imaginative iconoclast, Fred perceives that the writer and the man, despite the two names, are a unified personality. Fred, related to Justin only in the brotherhood of biography, portrays, and I'm quoting Fred Kaplan here, a unified Victorian American to the extent that any human being can be unified, no more and no less complicated, let alone divided, than any of his contemporaries. His pseudonym does not embody an attempt to escape from his other self or a fundamental internal division. Although he was a man of many inconsistencies, they do not add up to a split personality. On the contrary, they are the expression of the usual way in which people in Western culture, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries, respond to the pressures of daily life and play out their multiple desires and allegiances. I'm not going to read too much more from this review, though I'd like to, because I want to get on to some other examples. But Fred Kaplan's an interesting case because not only did he write a biography of Mark Twain, he's also published a biography of Henry James. Now, that's in the wake of Leon Edel, who published a 5-volume biography of James, reduced it to 2 volumes, then reduced it again to 1 volume. And it at one point seemed to have a lock on the Henry James biography market. And Fred Kaplan, you might call him a biographologist, says, not so fast. There's another way of looking at the figure. Well, I could go on about the Twain biography, but and other Twain biographies. I also reviewed one by Ron Powers, which is in my book, Lives of the Novelist, but I want to skip that and go on to another part of what I mean by biographology, and that's the term I call provenance. You know, art historians want to know about the provenance of a masterpiece. It's a part of establishing its authenticity. Is this really a Van Gogh or Renoir or whatever famous artist you want to name? Where is the biographer coming from? What ties does the biographer have to the subject other than the one of writing about the subject? I reviewed a biography of Eudora Welty by Suzanne Mars, who's a Welty scholar. And I begin my review by saying, consider this a column on the politics of biography. Some biographers make themselves, others are adopted. Once again, some biographers make themselves, others are adopted. Hold on to that thought. Which one am I? Oh, I've made myself. No one's adopted me. No one said, oh, Carl, please write my biography. I've never been commissioned or consigned. Most of the biographies I've written would not have existed if I hadn't persisted. Suzanne Mars belongs to the latter category, that is, she's an adoptee, which means her work has been given the imprimatur of the Welty establishment, a confederacy of academics and literary figures gathered round the shrine of St. Eudora. By the way, I read this once as a paper to a group of Weltians. It didn't go down so well. I give her, St. Eudora, that honorific because no American writer in living memory has been so adored. As Ms. Mars acknowledges, Welty projected an image of gentle integrity and humane good humor that made her seem a paragon. She received nearly 40 honorary degrees, maybe more, Ms. Mars is not sure, which get their own appendix in this biography. No anthology of American literature can do without a Welty story, such as the comic classic, Why I Live at the P.O. Only William Faulkner ranks more highly in the pantheon of Southern literature. I posted on Facebook this morning a piece about Salman Rushdie and his account of sitting next to Eudora Welty and trying to make talk, small talk with her, and mentioning Faulkner and how their proximity. And Welty makes this caustic comment about, you know, I live in Jackson, he lives in Oxford. That's a long ways away, more or less. That's not the Eudora Welty you get in Suzanne Mars, by the way. Welty put the finishing touches, back to my review, Welty put the finishing touches to her consecration in her charming and best-selling One Writer's Beginnings that was published in 1984. Ms. Mars notes that Welty hoped to head off biographers with this memoir. John Updike did something similar. Doesn't work. Updike's book was called Self-Consciousness. Certainly, Welty made it hard for any biographer to probe deeper without seeming a spoil sport. But in Writing a Woman's Life, critic and biographer Carolyn Heilbrunn, this was in 1988, questioned Welty's autobiography, wondering why was the woman who had made a, where was the woman who made a literary career? Where were the ambition, the irony, and bitterness that mark, at least to some extent, all writers' lives? The sanctification had reached such a pitch in the early 1990s that a blaspheming biographer was bound to desecrate the temple. For once, it wasn't me. I now have to declare an interest. I encouraged Anne Waldron to write the first biography of Welty, published as Eudora, A Writer's Life. Author of acclaimed biographies of Caroline Gordon and Hodding Carter, this is no blurb, check the record, Ms. Waldron, a native Southerner, did a creditable research job that is on Welty. Even though she did not have full access to her subject's papers, and the Welty establishment shunned her. I've had this experience with literary figures, being the outsider, or the outlier, you might call it. I have a thick skin. I know going in that it's not going to be easy, but I have to tell you, as I say, I encouraged Anne Waldron to do her biography of Welty, and I had long talks with Anne Waldron about how it wasn't going to be easy because people were going to be very protective about Eudora Welty. Anne seemed to understand. She got a wonderful contract from Doubleday and proceeded. Her books, as I said, have been really well received. And when she began to get these rejections, some of them rather nasty and off-putting, she was shocked. Shocked, I tell you. And her feelings were hurt. She was so well-meaning. What to make of this? And she poured out her heart to me. And I said, Anne, don't you remember our talks? Don't you remember my talking about what it was like to work on Martha Gellhorn and Susan Sontag and have people come after you and also people not talk to you for sure and to be rejected again and again and that you'd have to be prepared for this? I said, Anne, weren't you listening? I said, Anne, did you think it was just me? And she said, yeah, I thought it was just you. Well, it wasn't just me and it won't be just me if you attempt to do something like this. Well, they go on to say in this review, I'm not gonna read from more parts of it, except to say that why did Mars get adopted? Well, she was a wealthy scholar, number one. But number two, as I suggest in this article, you know, Welty had failed in dissuading from someone to do a biography of her. And therefore, she needed another biographer. And that's where Mars came in, the trusty person to take place. Now, Mars did not write a bad biography, but in many ways, it's not as sharp as Anne Waldron's. As I say at the end of the review, such truths as we can find in Mars's book show up in much more pointed fashion in Waldron's book. Miss Mars certainly provides more facts and a much more intimate view of Welty's love life. For Weltians, this biography is indispensable, but its provenance has to be taken into consideration in order to identify the biographer's blind spots. I have a long piece in Lives of the Novelists about George Orwell, and I'm not going to read it all. I go through 7-8 Orwell biographies and talk about why there are so many differences in the way Orwell is treated. Partly it depends on shifts in the culture and other aspects of Orwell that writers become interested in. Partly there's a tremendous market, frankly, there has been anyway, for Orwell biographies. And there are differences in tone and approach given who the biographies are. I'll just read you the last paragraph in the Orwell, where I'm talking about Sonia Orwell, Orwell's second wife, who was very obstructive. Got to learn a lot about Sonia because she was friends with Michael Foote, one of my biographical subjects. Does Sonia matter that much? I say, she does, because seven biographers so far continue to unravel the evidence she tried to suppress or manipulate for nearly three decades following her husband's death. For that story, Mr. Sheldon, Michael Sheldon, one of the Orwell biographies, and Jeffrey Myers provide better copy than the more gentlemanly Messrs. Boker and Taylor, two other biographies of Orwell. So again, lots to choose from there. They all, in one way or another, have certain merits, and you can't really deal with Orwell biography or read a biography of Orwell and think you've gotten the picture. You just don't. That's what Luke Castor-Miller is trying to show in the Bronte myth, how this myth got created, how people got interested in the Brontes, how important Mrs. Gaskell is in establishing the foundation of what Miller calls the Bronte myth. I'm right about this in Lives of the Novelists. And again, I'm not gonna read this to you. You can read it in the book or listen to it on audio if you wish. But one of the things she points out is something that Herbert Butterfield says in George III and the Historians, and that is the first biographer establishes certain things about the subject and about researching the subject that pave the way for other biographers and that can never quite be overturned. There are still aspects of Elizabeth Gaskell's biography, even though she held back certain things. There are certain aspects of her biography that you have to go back to Gaskell to get them, in other words. No biographer can quite, in some respects, supersede her. No biographer, I say in the review, has yet rivaled Mrs. Gaskell's achievement, which is not to say that these other biographers like Juliet Barker and Lindell Gordon, for example, are not persuasive. Both biographers receive high praise for reorienting the focus back upon the Brontes' writings. For the curious thing is that Mrs. Gaskell hardly dealt with the work at all, So intent was she on rehabilitating Charlotte at what a later reader called a womanly woman, because if you read the reviews of Charlotte Bronte when her work came out, one of the words that we use for her is that she was coarse, that she was unwomanly, a very Victorian view of her that Mrs. Gaskell was trying to counter. Maybe I'll end with this review I did of Patrick O'Brien, The Making of a Novelist by Nikolai Tolstoy. Not so much for this book itself, but for what I say about biography. And this will give you a clue as to what I do when I review a biography. My first paragraph here. Before reading a biography, check the acknowledgments and any prefatory passages the biographer includes that identify the auspices that have assisted his narrative. Who gets to tell the story of someone else's life? Biography is a genre generated out of the peculiar politics of family relationships and literary history, often a fraught and fractured legacy. We're going through that now with the Philip Roth biography, his attempts to control his life, the reactions to Blake Bailey's biography after what was known about Bailey himself. What's unusual about the whole controversy over Blake Bailey, to go back to that subject for just a minute, is we're learning so much about the biographer. That's what you don't learn in most biographies. And what you don't want to know, actually, that is, as a reader of biography, if I write a biography and I spend half the time talking about myself, you're going to be really annoyed. I can do it in this podcast. But God help me if I try to do it in a biography. I can sneak it in, or if I have some special affinity with the subject or a friendship with the subject, as with Michael Foote and Jill Craigie, or I've been there in 1963 in England right after Sylvia Plath died, and I know something of the culture, having been there for many of my biographies and made over 40 trips to the country. I can pull rank in a sense. I can bring in those kinds of things into a biography, but in general, you can't become a character. You can't become Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby as a biographer, or you can if you're Norman Mailer and you already have this literary reputation and you're using it or trading on it in some sense. You can include yourself in the book, although even there, if you're reading about Marilyn Monroe, a number of readers are certainly annoyed with his presence in the book. I'm not, because I understand what he's trying to get at about biography. He's trying to get at the provenance. He's trying to get at what his interest is in Marilyn Monroe. He's candid about it in a way that biographies usually aren't. At best, they'll write an essay after they've written the biography and they'll lay their cards on the table. But in the biography itself, they're not likely to do that. And that's why I wish reviews of biography and biographers were more candid and more inquisitive about the process in which these stories get made. Well, I won't read this last review. I think I've made my point, which is biographology is an inquiry into origins, into provenance, into the way a book gets made. And it's tiresome, frankly, to read all these reviews which treat biographies as sheer content, with the knowing reviewer retailing the life, the story of a life which the reviewer, in fact, has gotten from that book. So I just urge upon you that notion of biographology. And by the way, I did this column for the New York Sun for 3 years. And I've given you examples of what I did in the reviews. And I have to say, my 3 years of reviewing, which were just wonderful, and actually gave me the impetus to write another 7 biographies I never thought I was going to do. It was like a pause in my career as a biographer to think about the nature of biography. The New York Sun folded, although it still has a bit of a presence online. And I think because it was the New York Sun in New York, swamped by the New York Times, and because of its conservative politics, and who knows why else, my 3 years of doing a column on biography and what I call biographology, I have to tell you, I made, I think, virtually no impact whatsoever on the reviewing of biography. So on that cheery note, I will leave you until the next time. Thanks for listening.